folks, we're back with the American Awakening. Michael Herzog, your host, with my special guest, Ryan Dawson, the author of The Separation of Business and State, that you can get on Amazon.com. That's a must read, folks. I'm going to order a copy of it myself. I just want to see what's inside this guy's mind to the deepest degree. Ryan, back with you. All right, let's get into a little bit of the overview, maybe a little history about this, because, you know, when you go out in the mainstream public, and I did this back when I was, you know, in my former life out there in the field, you know, talking to senior citizens, I would hear this all the time. Well, whatever happens, we have to protect Israel. And that's been brainwashed into people for God knows how long. But let's get a little overview of the history of this. Ryan, go ahead.
What? You know, protecting their internationally illegal occupation isn't protection. I mean, you're defending their offense. That's offense. You know, bombing people's offense. It's not defense. What people don't understand is Israel openly demolishes homes, replaces them with this self-proclaimed chosen race of God. They have, and these aren't just little settlements, as they call them. They're cities. There are Jewish-only cities. That means only Jews, no other kind of ethnicity can live there in the occupied territories in the West Bank, which they took by force from private property owners. You don't have to get in this long argument with religion and stuff. These people had private property. Israel went in there with bulldozers and machine guns, destroyed their homes, replaced them with Jewish-only homes, and either killed them, imprisoned them, or at minimal, made them homeless because the Palestinians have to leave. And when they oppose it and they burn their crops and they vandalize the property that they haven't demolished yet, and the settlers just run ruckshot over the West Bank while they're protected by the IDF. Then on top of that, the Israelis have built this giant apartheid wall, which is not on their border. They built it inside of Palestine. Thus, all the territory between the wall and the Israeli border has been annexed to Israel. And then they wrap the wall around their little racial colonies. They call them settlements. The American news calls them Jewish neighborhoods. But these are racially exclusive cities captured by force and protected by a standing army. There's nothing to protect there. I mean, could any other country in the world get away with that? Or internally, can you imagine just going and stealing part of Mexico and making white-only cities or vice versa?
Well, absolutely. Ryan, if I might interject here, this poses the question, and I'm going to ask you this from your perspective. In your mind, okay, why is the U.S. so complicit in this? Why are they so ironclad that Israel, and you know, they say, well, it's the only democracy in the Middle East? Expound on that a little bit, because this is what the mainstream media is touting out all of the time. Well, we know that's not true, but
yeah,
expound
one,
on
it's
that.
Not a democracy, and if it was, it would not be the only democracy in the Middle East. There are plenty of democracies in the Middle East. They just decide to declare that they're not democracies because they don't vote for who they want them to vote. I mean, even in Palestine had democratic elections, and they voted for Hamas, which, of course, Israel created to begin with. But that's another story. Israel is a theocracy, for sure, and it's an apartheid regime. And being a democracy or not, there's nothing that makes you immune from, you know, abusive practices because you're a democracy or not. I mean, Hitler got elected, too. I mean, there are plenty of democracies, the United States being one, that go around and murder millions of people, as we have in Southeast Asia, Iraq, Korea, etc., and Latin America. I don't know how many when you add all that up. It doesn't make you immune from abuse because you're democratic. And the United States is only democratic on paper. It's a plutocracy. It's ruled by money. But the reason they support Israel is the same reason they support religious fanatics in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia and Syria and everywhere else. That's the same reason they finance the Taliban, the same reason they finance the Mujahideen or Jandallah, even ISIS, Al-Qaeda, all these, and Al-Shabaab in Somalia. All these, it doesn't matter if they're fanatical Muslims or Jews, the Zionists, they always support the religious fanatics because they have a very predictable consequence, which is going to be ethnic strife and war. And that's the whole point, is to purposely generate conflict because perpetual conflict is perpetual profit, and the mass media is completely beholden to parent companies that overlap with government welfare-sucking defense industries who obviously generate war and support despots in Egypt, Bahrain, Israel, all over Africa. It doesn't matter which religion or not. Sometimes they support the Muslims, sometimes they don't, sometimes it's the Jews or whatever, because they want to cause ethnic strife and conflict. That's why you see them all the time playing both sides in the Iran-Iraq war. You see them first fight ISIS, then they finance them in Syria. Now they're bombing them again. Keep the sides even. And it's the old Israeli plan from Oded Yinon, as a strategist in the 80s, to get the Kurds and Shiites and Sunnis to fight each other. After World War II, we had the Cold War, even though millions died during the Cold War, so you could call it a hot war. The weapons industries never died. They grew so huge during that time of crisis, and they did not want to scale back during peacetime. And from the end of World War II to now, there's been one conflict after another, because you have to have conflict to justify military spending. And you're talking about over half of all the discretionary taxes that the United States spends is on the military. And it's not on soldiers. They don't care. That's cannon fodder. They're spending it on the weapons industries. One F-22 fighter plane costs $480 million, almost half a billion dollars, for one aircraft that doesn't even work. The pilots are passing out from the oxygen and stuff. You can see this kind of corporate welfare, but because it's under the theme of the military, which people love the military because they don't think of it on the side of the weapons manufacturers. They see the courageous soldiers, the honorable, the people risking their lives. That's what they view the military as. And so they kind of unconditionally support it. But what they don't realize is they don't give a damn about the soldiers. The government doesn't give a damn. They're just making profits off of them, and they could care less how many of them die.
Well, you know,
look at how they treat
Ryan,
the veterans.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know. I mean, yeah, and I pulled up something this morning that says that for the amount of money that they've so far put in the F-35 fighter jet project, which is a complete disaster, they could buy every homeless person in this country a $667,000 house. But yet they will do this, you know, with a military budget, a defense budget, when the entire premise of every war that's going on that we're involved in is offense. It's not defense. There's nobody coming into our shores except for a bunch of undocumenteds that are pouring over the border. At any rate, we're looking at this. Another question I have for
The main terrorists in the United States are the police force. They're the one. They've killed more people than Al-Qaeda.
I believe it's more. You're 8 times more likely to get killed by a police officer than you are by a terrorist, and even that's being ramped up. But one other thing I wanted to throw in here is that this, you know, this Senate resolution that they passed about supporting Israel was 100-0. Everybody across the board voted for it. You'd think there'd be 2 or 3, but it looks to me like that the it's the tail wagging the dog, that the Israeli government has such a tight grip on the gonads of the American politicians that they dare not do anything. AIPAC, the lobbying, that they will destroy any politician that votes against Israel. Okay, how did they get here, Ryan?
Well, I mean, you'd have to go all the way back to JFK for that story, but AIPAC used to be called the American Zionist Council. And basically, it's an unregistered foreign agent. They're able to legally bribe a foreign government. Oh, here's the music. All right, we'll get to that story after the break then.
Bribing a foreign government. We'll get there in a minute. Okay, we'll be back at 3. Michael Herzog, The American Awakening, coming to you live from Round Rock, Texas, with my special guest, Ryan Dawson. Separation of Business and State is the book. Best way to buy it's on Amazon, folks. Be right back.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
All right, folks, we're back, and Ryan Dawson and I aren't backing down today. The author of The Separation of Business and State, available on Amazon.com. Let's talk about bribing those politicians. Ryan, go ahead.
Yeah, basically you have this cyclical relationship where the lobby, and AIPAC's really a kind of an umbrella lobby with lots of little lobbies under it, but that's the main one. They go and they bribe Congress, mainly the Senate, to allocate money to Israel, which they do. But when you look into the, and these are, this is, aid is not a loan, because the loans are forgiven every year. They just give them $3 billion. And what happens is 75% of the $3 billion is earmarked to be respent on U.S. armaments. So it's basically corporate welfare for Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Raytheon, etc., with a theme. But the other 25%, Israel gets to spend on what it wants. And it takes a portion of that money to go bribe Congress. Congress doesn't care because they're not giving away their own money. They're giving away your money. So they get bribed from AIPAC, so they get make a buck. They give away your money, so you lose a buck. And then Israel gains a buck, and a portion of that goes back into the defense industries, which is another major lobby. And so they all win, and the only loser is the American people and the Palestinians and the rest of Israel's neighbors. But this is totally illegal. Foreign states, everyone would do that, obviously, but they have what's called the Foreign Registration Act, FARA. And every single country in the world has signed it besides Israel. I mean, the U.S. is a pretty new country, but Israel's a brand new country. And so most of the countries were established before the United States even existed. So once it came around, they registered as foreign agents, and they're not allowed to do this kind of bribing gambit. But since Israel never existed until 1948, it got around that by saying it had a Jewish lobby instead of an Israeli lobby, even though Israel's in the title of AIPAC. It was the American Zionist Council, but they're not lobbying for Jewish interests. They're lobbying for a country's interests, mainly Israel. Zionism's a political ideology, and it does incorporate a bit of, you know, religious racism and all that. But that's not an ethnicity. It's just, I mean, it's the same as any other kind of supremacist movement. A bunch of racists, but they can't speak for everyone. And so the Kennedys went after him. You have to realize they basically had Eisenhower and then the Kennedys. I mean, Israel's a brand new country. Eisenhower got on Israel's case when they started two different wars in the 50s with false flags. The Levant affair is infamous. I call it the Benjamin Gavili affair because actually the defense minister, Pinhas Levant, was set up. Not that he was a nice guy or anything, but he doesn't deserve all the blame. Operation Susanna happened, and the Brits and the French and the Israelis all bombed the Egyptians. They did that twice. Eisenhower is having none of it. So he sent in he arranged for a ceasefire, and then they put the UN peacekeepers there from 1957 until 1967. And the 5 days after they were removed, Israel invaded again. But what happened during the Kennedys, now everyone knows JFK was killed in 1963 in November. But he was the last president ever to go after Israel to force them to sign FARA and become a foreign agent so that they couldn't outright bribe the United States and do what they do. And he wasn't alone. Of course, the attorney general was his brother. Everyone knows that. That was Robert Kennedy. And together they went after Israel for that. And they also went after Israel for their secret nuclear program in Dimona, which Mordecai Vanunu took pictures of. And the Israelis put him in solitary confinement for 11 years for it. And then he got out. And then they put him back in jail. Both Kennedys ended up dead. Robert was killed by a Palestinian, allegedly. How about that?
And then, coincidence. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, if you want to know more on that story, see Decades of Deception. It's free. It's on YouTube. It's on Vimeo. It's a film I made. I'm going to make a proper Kennedy film in the future, but or listen to the interviews with Jeff Gates and Grant Smith on ancreport.com. You can Google that later. I got in depth in the Kennedy story. But yeah, what a coincidence. And then what happens? LBJ gets in and the 1960 war and the USS Liberty, and you know the story from there. He sent the ship in to be sunk. He said, I want that GD ship on the bottom of the ocean. Of course, some very mindful sailors survived the attack and were able to say that the Israelis attacked them in unmarked planes for hours and shot up the lifeboats and everything else, which is not shocking given Israel's behavior today. I mean, they've never changed. They don't obey any rules of war. They're war criminals, and they've always been war criminals. And so they backpedaled this ridiculous story to say, first they tried to blame the Egyptians, and then they said, okay, we did it, but we thought it was an Egyptian boat. And that's a lie. They knew it was an American ship. But they needed to get rid of the Liberty because Liberty was in a position to know that the Israelis started that war by bombing the Egyptian Air Force. Part of Egypt's military was in Yemen at the time, fighting against the Wahhabi Saudis. So Israel took the opportunity to strike mainly because the UN peacekeeping forces had been removed. And another thing that a lot of people missed during that war is the Egyptians moved out of what's now Gaza because they upheld their side of the agreement. And the moment they left, the Israelis moved in and occupied it. And so, and they stole all this territory during the 1967 war. And then we had all this international backlash for it, that they're supposed to have the 1967 borders, but Israel has been slowly encroaching into the Golan Heights, which is part of Lebanon and Syria, and of course the West Bank, which they've gobbled up all the land worth anything with water, hills, or anything. They have it already with their Jewish-only highways and Jewish-only cities. And they occupied Gaza all the way up until modern times, until Bush's roadmap, where they didn't dismantle their settlements. They relocated them to the West Bank because they wanted to gobble up East Jerusalem. That was their main goal. And right after they moved the settlers out, the squatters, they bombed Gaza back into the Stone Age. And that gets us to where we are today with their cyclical bombings since 2006 into Gaza.
Okay, well, I want to touch on a couple of points here, and not meaning to interrupt you, but, you know, we had a ceasefire for 3 days. Negotiations fell apart. That didn't work. We've got the mission accomplished declared where they went in, and they finally got all the tunnels, but yet they go back in there. You know, and now there's currently a ceasefire for more negotiations, and what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Ryan, but literally what the Palestinians are trying to do, or Hamas is trying to do, is they're trying to go back to, you know, make an agreement going back to the land situation prior to the 67 war. Is that correct? In other words, Israel giving them back the land that they took from them?
Well, what they mainly want, well, I want to address two things and then I'll answer that, because the first 72-hour ceasefire was not something that Hamas and Israel created themselves. It was something Sisi, the dictator in Egypt, who, remember his first day in office, what he did? He shut the tunnels off going to Egypt from Gaza because he's anti-Hamas. But that was something the Egyptians and the Israelis came up with, along with Tony Blair, even though it's none of his business. Hamas had no part in that. No Palestinian faction had a part in that. They decided to create this ceasefire. It's all up to Israel to ceasefire anyway. They're the only ones that's having their missiles land on top of people anyway. And Hamas decided to listen to it, but they gave them an offer they couldn't possibly accept because they offered them nothing. They just want them to disarm and completely obey, where Hamas wants to lift the blockade. And this is vitally important since Sisi came into power in Egypt after their multiple revolutions, which is a long story, but They have nothing, because during Cass-led, the Israelis went and bombed all the agricultural centers, chicken farms, any kind of food production that was left in Gaza, and they can't import anything because, even with, you know what happens when the ships come, the Israelis attacked Myanmar, they won't allow any trade into Gaza. Egypt has closed the tunnels, and this is another lie that Israel tells about the tunnels. They say it's to attack Israel. Well, why? If they're attack tunnels, why are the majority of the tunnels not even going to Israel? They go to Egypt. Because prior to Sisi, in that interim period between Mubarak and Sisi, when Morsi was in power, they got around the Israeli border guards by digging underneath and doing black market trades with Egypt. It was for food. It was for supplies. And it's not for weapons, because if they had any weapons, they'd use them. They're building homemade rockets out of plumbing pipes and things. They have nothing. The majority of these tunnels were an attempt to break the blockade. That's why they go south rather than north. They're not attack tunnels. Now, they did have crisscrossing a separate type of tunnel in Gaza, which were to avoid bombs. I'll explain that after the break, too.
Okay, we'll explain tunnels after the break. Ryan Dawson, my special guest today. Another segment coming up. The book, Separation of Business and State, on Amazon.com. See you in three, folks. Stick around for more. Folks, we're back with the American Awakening. My special guest, Ryan Dawson. Go ahead and continue where you left off. We got one segment left, so let's pack as much as we can in there, Ryan.
Oh, well, so the tunnels pretext was BS. I mean, the tunnel system was created to break the blockade for black market trade. Now, they set up a tunnel system crisscrossing in Gaza. Basically, they're bunker busters. They built them under the ground far enough to avoid the Israeli artillery and mortar rounds and missiles. And so the Israelis could flatten the area. They could kill all the civilians. They've killed 2,000 already just this time. But they still have to go in and get the people firing rockets because they're in the tunnels, which the Israelis did. And I don't know whether they either learned from or by watching or directly or have involvement with Hezbollah, but they've definitely a bit better trained this time around than last time. Hamas has been catching these Israelis, even though they have the tanks and armored vehicles and all the superior weaponry and money and everything. And they've found ways to crisscross them and trap them in these tunnels and inflict casualties on these Israeli soldiers. And that finally led to the second ceasefire, which Hamas had a say in. But I suspect what the Israelis will try to do to save face is make a deal with the Palestinian Authority rather than Hamas, because they don't want to lose the war. They have a couple things going on. If they get soldiers killed, they lose domestically. If they don't kill enough Palestinians, they lose domestically. But if they murder too many civilians, they lose internationally, besides America and Canada.
Are you saying that killing 2,000 people isn't throwing that over the tipping point yet?
Not in the United States, because if you're sane, compassionate, or normal, well-adjusted person, you would say killing children is wrong. I mean, obviously. But there, you know, because of identity politics, there are people who, for religious reasons or ethnic reasons or whatever, they just support their team no matter what. Just like Republicans and Democrats, it's like a cult, so that they can rationalize no matter how stupid the excuse is, it will work for them. Kind of like the people who supported the war in Iraq. They believed in the weapons of mass destruction because they wanted to, even though there was no physical evidence and it didn't make sense. That doesn't matter. You just offer any kind of flimsy excuse for people to latch on to because they believe what they want to. It's kind of a vicarious masculinity type of thing, like rooting for a sports team. They just want whatever they identify with to win. So you see a lot of Christian Zionists and ethnic Jews siding with Israel just because they associate with the familiarity with it more than they do the Arabs.
Well, it's easier that way. That's the easy road out, because to take a good, strong look at it and find out what's really going on, it would cause them to reach a crossroads and have to make a decision. But I wanted to ask you, Ryan, and because I've heard this snippet come off here and there and the other place, that the part of the motivation for this, basically this catastrophe, is offshore natural gas pipelines. Do you see, or offshore natural gas deposits of a trillion cubic feet or whatever, do you see any relationship between this and that?
Well, that was part of the conflict with Lebanon. I don't think Palestine's really a threat to that. They don't have the infrastructure to do it. They barely have fishing boats. They can't even get trade in as it is. The pretext for this was the one, there was a unity government, which infuriated Netanyahu. because he could no longer be dismissive and say, well, Hamas is a terrorist organization, because they're willing to meet all of Israel's demands. And then three settlers were kidnapped and killed by whoever. It wasn't Hamas, individual criminals. One Israeli sniper and two other settlers were murdered. Now, that's a tragedy. But, you know, murders happen every day. Look at America, Chicago. I'm sure someone died tonight. Washington, D.C., Richmond. One person a day is murdered, at least. It happens, and it's sad. But you don't collectively punish the entire city, much less the entire country, because someone got murdered. Hamas didn't kill these kids, even though one of them was a 19-year-old sniper in the Israeli army. It was individual criminals who were not associated with Hamas. They actually opposed Hamas. And yet, and it happened in the West Bank, and somehow they extrapolated from that some kind of cockamamie reason to attack Gaza in general. All of them, even the babies and everything. And you routinely have Israeli politicians saying insanely racist things, and there's no consequence for it, that they should kill Palestinian mothers who give birth to snakes and things like that. And Gaza got collectively punished because three Israeli teenagers were killed. And look how much this was in the media. Three Israeli teens died. How many teenagers, kids, whatever, have died in Iraq or Syria or Libya? Or pick a place. How many die every day since the invasion in Iraq? And then look at Africa. And that's not on the news. But three Israeli Jews die, and it's on every channel 24/7 as a pretext for war. And seriously sit down and think about that. It's really sad for anybody to be murdered. But usually when someone's murdered, a country doesn't invade the other country and say, well, you have a... coincidentally, you have genetic and geographic similarities to the people who did the killing, so we're just going to bomb all of you. And the sicker thing is, the Israelis knew these three teens were dead. They had audio recording of the shots. They had blood all over the car. They knew who did it. They knew they were dead. And they pretended like, oh, we're looking for them. They used it as a pretext to invade over 700 houses. They demolished two of them. They killed 10 Palestinians. They murdered 10 people. And then Jewish terrorists grabbed a Palestinian boy, 16 years old, forced him to drink gasoline, tortured him, and burned him alive. And then the police were caught beating up his American cousin later. And all of this is going on, 10 dead, plus the lynchings and things from the settlers. And then Hamas fired rockets, and then Israel fired missiles in return. But they start the story in the middle, saying that the whole thing was because of Hamas's rockets. And they're not talking about how they threw all these people in prison, or the houses they raided, or the houses they destroyed, or the 10 Palestinians they killed. Not to mention the ongoing daily occupation and house demolitions that they have anyway, and the blockade and the false arrests and everything else that they have to put up with every day.
Well, let me ask you, do you anticipate in your mind any positive results coming from this latest round of ceasefire?
Yes, I do. I think possibly, because The whole world, besides the bought and paid for United States and their lackeys in Canada, absolutely condemns what Israel did and is threatening to prosecute them for war crimes. Now, America's not going to allow that, but to not allow it, they're going to have to give something up. And I believe it is possible that they could have, in some limited way, lift the blockade and maybe have a UN monitored seaport or something, at least one seaport, so that they can bring in basic supplies, agricultural products, building products, etc.
Or they can leave, right? I mean,
or flee, yeah. Exactly.
Because right. There's no place to go right now. I mean, they could flee into the Mediterranean if they've got a life jacket, but that's about it.
that's the other thing. They have nowhere to go. And that was another clever tactic that Hamas did. They shut down the Ben Gurion airport just by firing some rockets near it. And, of course, the Iron Dome interceptors are actually the real threat to the airplanes, not the rockets.
No, and that was amazing because Benjamin Netanyahu stepped back and said, no, no, wait a minute, it's safe to go in there because those airliners get, I think, between $2,500 and $3,500 the airport gets every time one of them touches down, if I remember. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it hurt their economy, and of course, and they're, you know, like anybody else, and even more so, they're about the money. They don't want that money to stop.
They don't want that money to stop, and psychologically, they thought, wait, we can't leave? It scared them.
Right. Okay, well, I hear the music. Hey, Ryan, thank you so much for coming on and spending an hour of your valuable time with us. I really appreciate it, and I'm, for sure I'll have you up again, okay? Thank you.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, ancreport.com. We'll have more updates.
ancreport.com. And he posts on Facebook, folks, and I watch it all the time. So thanks again, Ryan.
Thank you,
Separation
Michael.
Of Business and State. You can buy it on Amazon. Second hour coming up. Stick around. I've paid.